Hello and welcome to the Freight Find Podcast, your source for all things freight transportation. I'm Chris Kaplis, Chief Scientist at DAT Freight and Analytics, and this is the first Freight Find episode for 2022. We're kicking off the new year with a person I've been wanting to have on as a guest for a long time, Adrian Gonzalez. Adrian has been in the transportation consultancy and advisory business for over 20 years. He was a director with ARC Advisor Group for over a decade, where he conducted market research on transportation management and many other logistics topics. In 2010, he formed Adelante, a peer-to-peer learning, networking, and research community for supply chain and logistics professionals. In 2019, he started Indigo, a trusted community of supply chain practitioners, really as a complement to Adelante. And we'll talk more about those two different companies. But through these two companies, Adrian has had great visibility into supply chain and logistics and really has a good understanding of the challenges and opportunities that the industry faces. In our conversation, we'll cover topics ranging from digital twinning of supply chains, the impact of the pandemic on labor, the never-ending challenges of data quality, and whether you can establish and maintain a trusted relationship via Zoom or any other digital platform. It's a great conversation. And following our discussion, I'll be joined by Dr. Enam Ayoub for the Truckload Market Update. So let's get started. Welcome to the Freight Find Podcast, Adrian.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Yeah, this is great. I've been meaning to have you on for a while. You're, I think, my 62nd show. And so I've been meaning to have you on for a while, but I'm glad we could make this work now. And because we've known each other for almost 15, 20 years, back when you were at ARC, back at the turn of the century, back when, you know, the world was going to change and everyone was going to be disintermediated. But since then, you've started two different organizations. And so I want you to tell me a little bit about those. It's Adelante and Indigo. Am I pronouncing those correctly?
You are. Yeah, absolutely. You're one of the rare few that get it right the first time.
So which one do you want to talk about first?
Sure. Well, actually, they're both under the same umbrella. And again, thank you for having me. And yes, you and I go back, you know, many years.
We both had hair back then.
Exactly. We both had hair. And just a quick story. I mean, you invited me to speak at one of your MIT classes many years ago. And at the end of class, you gave me a mug and said, you know, just a little token of appreciation. I got to tell you, even though I'm a Cornell grad, I reach for that MIT mug just about every morning for my coffee. So I still have that mug after so many years.
I'm glad we contribute to your coffee experience.
Exactly. So I've been an industry analyst now for 22 years. Every time I say that, you know, it shocks me because it doesn't seem like it's been, you know, 22 years. And it also means that I'm getting old. Yeah. So I started my career, you know, material science engineer, working in semiconductors at Motorola and other semiconductor companies. I had a short stint at Polaroid. And then I, like you said, I spent over a decade over at ARC doing, you know, that's where I really got started as an industry analyst, looking at supply chain logistics and transportation management and the like. And then this past November, I actually celebrated the 11-year anniversary of going off on my own and launching, you know, Adelante, which is, you know, the main company that we have. And probably the most visible aspect of what we do is Talking Logistics, which is our online video talk show and blog. And that's our vehicle to help educate the market on what's happening in the world of supply chain and logistics.
Got it.
And then in 2019, we launched Indigo, which is a curated and validated community of supply chain logistics practitioners, where we conduct, you know, weekly surveys, short, what we call micro surveys. We send out a survey every Monday. We close it every Thursday. Everybody gets results on Friday. Then we do it all over again on a different topic. And, you know, the cool thing is that, you know, it's repeatable, it's kind of real time, you know, kind of addressing real time topics, but there's also a connection to charity there. So all the members actually earn money for every survey that they take. And then we've aligned ourselves with five charities that once they reach $25, we donate that money to the charity that they selected.
Oh,
so
wow.
Since we launched, you know, we've donated almost $12,500 in charitable donations and payments. So it's kind of a cool little model there.
That is nice. Now, so how many members or companies do you think you have in Indigo?
So we have right now a little bit over 100 supply chain practitioners, and it's almost 100 distinct companies.
That's good.
And so it's we validate that every member is who they say they are. So you have to be a supply chain or logistics practitioner from a manufacturing, retail, or distribution company. So if you're the VP of transportation or supply chain at XYZ retailer, you have to provide your work email, you have to provide your LinkedIn profile. So, you know, it takes some time to make sure that, you know, we don't get someone there just to, you know, pretending they're somebody else just to get the results or participate.
Other analysts
or software vendors or, you know, the like. Because, you know, one of the things that I think is important for a lot of these practitioners is, you know, it's a confidential community. So they want to make sure, sure. that number one, they're amongst peers, and number two, that we're not going to disclose their information with others.
Yeah, DAT, we started having, pre-pandemic, we'd have a user conference once a year, a summit. But then during the first days of the pandemic, we said, oh, we need to stay in touch, right? And so we had weekly roundtables. And that just was not sustainable. But now we do it monthly, and it's really good. We probably have 150 total companies involved. We usually get 60 to 80 people on. And it's exactly what you say. It's peer-to-peer. And so my objective on those one-hour webinars or calls is to say as little as possible and let them talk to each other. Because it's really interesting and you learn a lot from it. But it's also helpful for them to hear what other people are doing.
Exactly. I mean, and that's really the thrust behind Adelante in general is to promote, you know, peer-to-peer learning, networking, and research. And I learn a lot from the results.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's, you know, what I tell folks is, hey, let's pretend you get, you know, we get anywhere from like 25 to 35, 40 responses to every survey every week. So I say, hey, just pretend you're getting 25 to 35 executives in a room every week doing a think tank session. And then we report out every Friday on what was discussed and what their perspectives and advice are relative to a particular topic. So
I can't sneak my way on there and make up a company.
No, you can't sneak your way in there. But if you're a 3PL or an academic or software company, we do have a model where you can subscribe to receive the reports and help help submit questions or topics for us to research on your behalf.
Sure. Yeah, that's great. Those must be keeping you pretty busy then, those two.
It keeps me busy. It keeps it fun and interesting. And again, it helps me to continue to keep a pulse on what's happening in the industry.
Yeah, so you're sitting in a catbird seat because you talk to so many different companies in both of these organizations. So let's talk about 2021 because you have a great perspective there. It was crazy. You know, everyone knows what a supply chain is now, right? Pause and tilt their head when you tell them I work in supply chain management. But what were the top one or two things that surprised you the most in 2021? Going in at the end of 2020, going into 2021, the vaccine was almost out. It was getting distributed. All this stuff was happening. What surprised you in 21?
Great question. I mean, part of me wants to say that nothing surprises me anymore, right?
Yeah.
I mean, once you've been in this industry for a while, you learn to expect the unexpected. I mean, just about every week, you know, I get some press release about some merger acquisition that I wasn't expecting, or it surprises me, or, you know, with the container ship blocking the Suez Canal, you know, there's always something, right, that it's kind of surprising. But if I had to pick one thing, I mean, I think it would be the, you know, everything that happened around ocean shipping, you know, last year, all the backups at the ports, you know, not only here in the United States, and which is still happening, you know, today, but even around the world. I mean, even right now, as we're talking, I mean, I saw news earlier this week that back in China, again, you know, there's backups there due to our COVID outbreak. And, you know, that's going to have a ripple effect ultimately, you know, on our shores here. And then when you think, you know, I was talking to shippers and they were talking about, you know, the rates that they were paying for ocean containers, you know, orders of magnitude greater than they had in the past. I mean, I have a neighbor here who's in the flooring business. And he was telling me in the fall, he said, Adrian, I mean, I normally pay $500 for a container to come in, and I'm paying $15,000 now. And his problem was, you know, these are orders that were signed months ago. So he's locked into the prices that he had locked into with those customers. So he goes, I can't go back to these customers and ask them for, you know, significant increase because, you know, I mean, I can, but they're under no obligation to, you know, pay me extra, you know, for these added costs. So I think that was probably the biggest surprise for me. You know, when you see ocean rates almost approaching air freight rates, I mean, I think that's something that was unheard of until I think last year.
What do you think caused it? Because I've had this discussion with a lot of different people. Do you think it's the demand definitely went up, or do you think the supply was constrained?
I think it was both. I think it was both. I mean, from you know, the folks that I've talked to, the research I've read from folks, I think it's a combination of both those things. You know, people having extra money in their pocket, you know, from stimulus checks and the like, and, you know, spending on goods and not still, you know, not going on vacations and not, you know, staying away from the, you know, so the services side was still depressed, but so that forced people to buy more stuff. I think if you looked at even, you know, you look at Long Beach and Oakland, right? And, you know, all the delays and the all the ships waiting to come in, but at the same time, they processed more containers than ever before, right? So, I that goes to show you that the import demand was, was high. So I think it was a combination of, you know, the way I look at it, Chris, is like, as you know, right? Supply chains are so many gears working together. And someone hit the emergency stop button last year when the pandemic hit. And now just everything trying to start up again just created this huge imbalance on both the demand side and the supply side.
Yeah.
And it's just been very painful to, you know, get back to a smooth, you know, running machine.
Yeah, I think it's funny because a lot of the payments and everything, there's a lot of, you're right, families are flush right now with money. And that did two things, right? Higher demand, people were buying stuff, but also the labor force. The big, big surprise for me is people not going back to work. I don't know where they are. I understand a lot of people retiring early. That makes sense to me, but it still seems our workforce participation numbers are still below pre-pandemic. And I don't know that. To me, that's the surprise because I thought vaccines are out. It's June, it's July. We don't need our masks anymore. I thought it was clear sailing and it's just gotten worse.
I think that's been a challenge as well. And I think, you know, that's outside my realm of expertise, but just from what I've read, I think it's a question mark for even economists to understand what's going on with the labor market. And everything you said is, you know, it's all of the above, right? It's people retiring early. Some folks saying it's, you know, the stimulus that was, people were getting paid not to work. Other folks that I saw an article not too long ago in the Wall Street Journal where, you know, you saw a lot of people exiting the workforce, but creating their own companies, right? Becoming their own entrepreneurs, saying, hey, you know what, this might be a good opportunity to, you know, work for myself and start something new that they maybe be thinking about.
I was just talking to someone today, a VP of transportation for a company, and she was talking about the problem with detention. She thought they'd be having worse detention problems because the labor force at the docks are just getting the connection between the transportation and the loading at the DCs is really fragile right now because if you're short some here, that delays a truck, which it's a ripple effect all the way down. So we'll see how that changes. What do you think, what did your customers or your partners say? What did they think was the biggest issue that you've seen as you've surveyed your different partners over the year?
Yeah, I mean, certainly transportation overall, right? And so not, you know, everything that we just talked about with on the ocean side was top of mind. But, you know, as you know, because you keep a pulse on this as well, you know, it wasn't just ocean, right? It had the ripple effect of all modes of transportation.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Trucking, right? Capacity constraints,
big time.
You know, the same dialogue over and over again about driver shortage. You know, spot rates going up, putting upward pressure on contract rates. And, you know, so the trucking side of things was a challenge for many companies. And they saw their transportation budgets, go through the roof. And you saw that in earnings calls and everything else, companies blaming overall transportation. It was, in addition to truckload, I mean, you even saw it in parcel, right? I mean, parcel, you know, I think prior to the past few years, you almost had this feeling that parcel had like infinite capacity, right? And then you realize, oh, maybe they were more capacity constrained during the holiday season. You know, certainly there were hiccups years ago with, peak season. But the reality was that with the big surge in e-commerce, it became peak season all year, right? So you started seeing, you know, the FedExes and the UPSs of the world actually turning down clients, which I think created an opportunity for a lot of regional carriers pick up business. So to me, transportation across the board was something that many of the companies I talked to were trying to figure out ways to navigate, you know, the environment. The other top area, which you brought up, is labor. That's been a big challenge for a lot of the companies that I've talked to. And not only on the driver side, those that have, you know, their own private fleets, but particularly on the warehousing and manufacturing front, you know, being able to find the right people and retain them. You know, a lot of turnover in those areas. You know, part of it, you know, COVID pops up here and there. So that's had a challenge. But to your point, I mean, a lot of people just not in the market, you know, so trying to find folks to, you know, align with the, to scale their operations has been very difficult, And then on the technology front, because I talked to a lot of folks about technology and trying to get a sense of what's important to them. Not surprising, visibility kind of topped the list yet again. But visibility in a very broad sense. It was not only visibility to supply, you know, visibility to, hey, what kind of inventory do we have on hand at stores or in our warehouses, but also visibility to goods in transit, right? Whether it's on an ocean ship or it's on a truck. And then extending back to all the way to their suppliers and their manufacturing operations, you know, trying to get a sense as far back into their supply chain to get a sense of the supply situation. And then also on the demand side, having more real-time visibility to demand, you know, this whole area of demand sensing. So visibility to demand, real-time visibility to demand, real-time visibility to supply. And then the third area is this whole area of digital twins, or having the ability to, you know, run these what-if scenarios to better plan, better, you know, respond to whatever uncertainties might, you know, different scenarios that might emerge in the weeks and months ahead. So yeah. I think those are the two main things, visibility and the ability to do digital twins and modeling and simulation to kind of be better prepared for the next disruption or to the next scenario that it might
emerge. Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned a parcel having capacity issues, but the other one that I saw this year, which I'd never seen before, is LTL. LTL always had infinite capacity, and now they're constrained because there's bleed over from truckload and parcel. So that used to be the worst position to be in, right? It's stuck between the two, and now they're like the safety valve. So that's really interesting. But for visibility, let me ask you a question about that, because having tried to sell visibility solutions back in the late 90s, early 2000s, it used to be a hard sell. Do you think the value there is the tracing and tracking, or getting the data that you can use strategically? Where do you see the visibility? Because it's used in multiple different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, going back, and the visibility, again, 22 years as an industry analyst, visibility is always ranked like the top one or top two of things that companies are always looking to get more of, right? And, you know, if you go back to, you know, 20 years ago with some of the early visibility solutions, the big problem was they were just software applications, right? You still had to get the data in there. And that was always the hard part, right? And it's still, in many ways, you know, the hard part today. But I think that has become easier today. Not that it's easy, but it's become easier because you're seeing some of these more network-based models out there where you're creating these, what I call the business equivalents of Facebook and LinkedIn and social media, where you're creating these platforms that are helping to aggregate and collect data from multiple trading partners and then feeding that into these, you know, visibility solutions. So I think right now, you know, there's been a lot of activity and buzz around real-time freight visibility solutions, right? And there's a number of players that are out there right now that quote-unquote unicorns from an investment standpoint, but that are growing very quickly because companies are, again, looking to have that visibility. So I think that there's better solutions today to address both those things, both the how to get data through APIs and web services, obviously mobiles now as part of the picture and sensors, right? This whole IoT. So there's been a lot of innovation and progress along the front of how do we collect data. But I think the bigger problem now in some ways, it's not so much the data collection, but it's, you know, drowning in data, right? How do we sift through all of this data that we're collecting, actually make sense out of it and actually figure out what actions to take in response to the data that we're
collecting. Exactly. That's one of the points that I was trying to get, because I'm a firm believer. A lot of times people want the visibility, but they're not going to, it's not like you're going to track each package. You just want to know when something bad's going to happen. Oh, but strategically. So give you an example, some of the stuff that we've done is to look at, you know, on time delivery and pickup at a facility. A company can manage, it can look at its own and track that. But what they really want to know is that facility, everything moving in there. Does it like a trucking company, they do this, they track this. What's the average detention time? How bad is it on different days? So that's the idea of getting the visibility data, but using it strategically. And exactly what you said, where you have to pool it together from multiple sources, because the real value is the network effect and being able to see across not just your own little view of the world in your company, but how is that doing across? Because like you said earlier, supply chains are so interconnected. And so knowing that information might help you make those better decisions.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think what you brought up is a good point, because I think what's different today than 20 years ago is that you do have access now to this benchmarking, you know, data.
Yeah.
You know, companies are always good to see how they were doing relative to how they were doing last year or how they were doing compared to their plan. But the question they always had a hard time answering was, how are we doing compared to others in the industry, or how are we doing compared to a broader metric? And I think now that there's more transparency and visibility to that type of data that gets incorporated as part of these visibility tools, that again is another, provides another level of insight to help companies take, you know, the right actions.
The other thing that I found talking to companies, one of the challenges they have, the transportation executives, is translating the weirdness of transportation up to a senior executive. And, you know, saying, why'd your budget go over by 40%? It's like, have you been reading the newspapers? You know, how do you translate what happens in truckload transportation into something? Because it's very different, right? And so what we found is a lot of these benchmarking or comparison services allows better translation of a supply chain issue to something senior management might understand a little better.
Absolutely.
Twinning, that's something that I've been passively following for a lot of years. And so the whole idea that you have a digital twin of usually like GE, whether it's locomotives, is probably one of the pioneers, where you have a digital twin of that physical object running. And so you can proactively determine if something's happening, maintenance, things like that. Have you seen it used much? Or it's almost like reshoring to me. Everyone talks about it, but I haven't seen it too much in the supply chain space. Do you have any examples for digital twins being used?
There are certain companies that have led the way in this area on the technology side, as well as the user side. You know, LlamaSoft, you know, is from a technology standpoint, is probably one of the companies that have innovated in this area.
You mean Coupa?
The Coupa now, right? I was going to say they got acquired by Coupa. So I remember back when they were LlamaSoft, I would attend their user conferences and, you know, and I would interview, you know, and I've interviewed in the past, I'm blanking off the top of my head which some of those companies are, but they had, these user groups, as you know, a lot of companies come together and share their experiences. So there are a lot of companies that have created what I would consider centers of excellence around supply chain design that have teams that, you know, do this, on behalf of the entire company. But at the same time, to your point, we actually did a survey with our Indago community last year and asked that same exact question. Are you using, you know, digital twin technology, or have you created a digital twin of your supply chain? And it was a very tiny percentage of our members who said that they are. You know, I think there's an education process that's still required here. I think for a long time, this type of technology was almost like the old days of any kind of optimization, right? There was this like, hey, you need a PhD in mathematics to be able to do this, right? Or you needed, they weren't very user-friendly, you know, to kind of set up and manage. I think the technology has come a long way in kind of making these solutions more accessible to business users. You don't need a PhD in mathematics to use. I think the time is right for companies who might have thought in the past, we don't need this, or we don't have the skills internally to set this up and manage this, to kind of take a second look. Because for me, one of the lessons learned out of the pandemic is that this, to me, it's becoming a must-have capability, because you really need to, if you want to be prepared for whatever the next scenario is, you know, whether it's a cyber attack, whether it's some geopolitical event that's happened, or another kind of natural disaster, you know, things that we've already experienced in the past, you've got to be able to understand your supply chain. You have to be able to model and simulate certain scenarios so that if and when it happens, you already have a game plan put in place. It's not going to be perfect, but at least you have a head start versus starting from scratch and not knowing what the heck to do.
So when you talk digital twins, because the traditional definition is a physical systems being digitized, an engine, a locomotive, an aircraft, and that's being done. But what you're talking about is of a system, right? So how do you create a digital twin of my supply chain? And so it's almost like you have to tie into some kind of simulation, but some predictive modeling, right? So that if X happens, then Y will probably happen afterwards. And you're right. That's a hard thing, one, to create, and two, to sell someone on, to make a senior executive really believe that, oh, this is what will happen with there. Have you seen that? Where do you see the hurdle for a company actually putting this in? Is it the technology, or is it the senior leadership buy-in? What do you think?
I think the biggest hurdle is, it goes back to almost what we were talking about before with the data and visibility solutions. The first step, really, before you even implement the digital twin solution, is you have to map your supply chain. So a related challenge, and we asked our entire community around this as well, and the results didn't surprise us, is a lot of companies have good visibility to their tier one suppliers, right? They know who their tier one suppliers are. They may know where their tier one suppliers have their manufacturing facilities, and they may know where their tier one suppliers, what products or components are manufactured at each of those tier one supplier facilities. But past tier one, they have no idea, right? Yeah, so there could be a little screw or nut or bolt that's manufactured by a tier three supplier that could be the critical constraint in their supply chain, but they have no visibility to who that supplier is. They have no idea where that supplier has its manufacturing plants or plant, you know, and what kind of capacity that supplier might have. So I think the first step really is doing the hard work of really understanding and putting pinpoints on a map to say, okay, here are all the suppliers, tier one, tier two, tier three. Here's where all of those suppliers have their manufacturing facilities. Here's what's produced at each of those manufacturing facilities. And then understanding, you know, from an exploding bill of materials standpoint, you know, how many products is that bolt in, you know, affect us? You know, how many products does that bolt affect? What is the potential impact to our revenue, to our profitability, and so forth? That's a very big task. Yeah, and virtually no companies have done that.
That is such a huge task. There are companies that have been formed, like Resilink tries to do this, where you even to know where stuff is manufactured is one step. But what's interesting there, it's very hard to do. Bruce Arnson, who used to be a researcher up here at MIT, he actually did a project trying to tie that in for a large company, but he found he couldn't use the ERP because SAP has the billing locations, right, for where the money goes. It doesn't have the physical location. So you'd have to create almost a side structure to the ERP. But the other thing is, and tell me if you agree with this or not, a lot of companies, suppliers, don't want you to know where everything is made because they might be changing it based on how they have to do it. There's not a willingness to share a lot of times because then that takes away some of your flexibility. Have you found that to be true, or is that do you not think that's true?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think it's that's true. I think the other thing is true is that a lot of companies say, hey, you know what, this is a lot of work. I'm just going to trust that my tier one supplier is going to do that due diligence, right? So they'll do the due diligence on my behalf with regards to the suppliers that supply them, right? So everything shouldn't be on my plate, you know? So I think this goes back to more broadly into the whole conversation, which we can talk for hours about, you know, the importance of collaboration, the importance of trust, the importance of understanding that, we really are a system, right? And, you know, the more that we can work together, the more success we'll all have versus if we kind of continue to work in these silos, you know, you're going to have these hiccups and then one's going to know, no one's going to have the full version of the truth. And that's where you get into, you know, into challenges.
Well, there was an interesting article in the New York Times recently about Tesla and about their more vertically integrated. Did you see this for their chips? They were hit less by the chip issues because they were able to redesign the software for the chips in-house, while the other companies, GM, Ford, and everything, didn't have that capability. Do you think that this will lead to more vertical integration, where companies will try to own more of their supply chain?
You know, I do. I don't think it will be I don't think it's going to be a wholesale type of move in that direction.
Back to River Rouge with Ford. We're not going to go back where they're going to have their own forest and rubber plants and everything.
No. Yeah, I don't think so. But we've seen other examples, right? In more recent weeks, right? We've seen retailers acquire 3PLs, right? To take more direct control of their logistics operations. Certainly Amazon's been doing that for several years, right? Kind of taking direct control of their fulfillment and delivery operations. So I think you'll see examples. I think there are a lot of examples out there where having more direct control of your supply chain is something that's becoming more appealing for companies in the areas that's going to make sense, you know, for them. And for some companies, I believe it's going to be on the logistics front. So I think that, you know, there are companies that might have outsourced some operations, whether it's transportation or warehousing and fulfillment. Whereas in the past, it might have been a cost center and not strategic. I think a lot of companies are saying, hey, you know what? We're starting to compete now on last mile logistics, and we're starting to compete on customer experience, and logistics and delivery play a big role in that. So maybe it's time to kind of take a more direct control over that. And I think that's a challenge for 3PLs, Because I think 3PLs need to convince their customers that outsourcing doesn't necessarily mean loss of control.
That's the challenge. But the funny thing is the number of brokers has increased tremendously over the last couple of years. And maybe it's just the market, it's easy to get in. There's no barriers to entry or exit. But it seems like companies are more willing to use 3PLs and brokers, non-asset-based providers. I'm curious if that's, do you see that changing? Do you see that going where there's going to be more direct relationship to carriers, that the whole brokerage side will get smaller? Or do you think that's here to stay?
Well, I mean, I think the brokerage side has always played a role, you know, for shippers, right? And, you know, particularly for that spot.
But it used to be tiny. It used to, when I ran bids back in the 90s and 2000s for transportation, the B word, brokerage, was a four-letter word. You didn't want them in the bid. I'd use them with my, you know, hold my nose if I had to use them, the carrier of last resort. And that's changed totally. People are using non-asset-based providers as part of their strategy now.
I think part of it is because, you know, a lot of shippers have recognized that they've been missing out on that long tail of the carrier base, right? So I think what a lot of brokers are bringing to the table, and not just brokers, I think one of these, you know, all the buzz the past few years, right, has been the digital, quote unquote, digital brokers, right? And part of the value proposition of these digital brokers and some of these other entrants in the market is to say, hey, we're tapping into that long tail of the carrier base, those small mom and pops who, you know, historically, you know, didn't have electronic integration. We didn't have electronic integration with, but now because of, you know, mobile apps and ELDs and other mechanisms, we're able to tap into that source of capacity now. So I think that's one of the driving forces why, you know, working with brokers, whether it's the quote traditional or quote digital, has been, you know, part of the broader strategy for a lot of shippers today, is to tap into that much broader base of capacity.
I agree, because they can't tap into it themselves. It's just too hard to manage that many small relationships. Let's flip to 2022, right? Going to a future year. I read recently one of your surveys for your Indago members was did they think would change or stay the same in 2022? And I was really surprised that the top two stay the same responses were struggling with poor data quality. It's 2022 after all. And Excel remains the king of supply chain software. What the hell's going on, Adrian? Do you believe both of these things? Do you think Excel is still the go-to? And do you think bad data is still the driving force here?
It didn't surprise me. And I'll tell you why. Because, you know, I mean, it's surprising or disheartening that it's still, you know, an issue. And I go back to, I'm sure you're familiar with this Harvard Business Review article, which I reference all the time. You know, it was back from 2001. You know, it was titled "The Achilles Heel of Supply Chain Management," and it was basically poor data quality is the Achilles heel of supply chain management. And 22 years ago, when as an industry analyst, when I would interview companies, and today when I interview companies around any kind of enterprise software implementation, let's say a TMS, and I would say, you know, what's been the hardest part of implementing the solution or deploying the solution, rolling it out? And fixing data and managing data, you know, always is in the top two, you know, along with, you know, change management, you know, issues or challenges.
But let me ask a question, because here's the thing. Do you think the quality of data has improved, or are we falling into the vacuum paradox where, you know, the vacuum cleaner was supposed to reduce the number of hours that someone spent cleaning their house, and all it did was raise the level of cleanliness that's accepted? So you spent the same amount of time. Do you think our level of what is quality data gotten higher? Is the bar higher now and we're asking data to do more? Will we always have poor data quality because our reach exceeds our grasp? Or do you think it's just still bad?
20 years ago, a lot of the challenges was just getting the data, you know, from because it was dispersed across many different systems. And because all these systems were built on proprietary platforms, I mean, that was the real, right. That was a bear of a project.
Right.
Fast forward to today, it's not quite plug and play, but all these software applications are built on standard platforms now. They're all leveraging APIs and web services. So kind of the transmission and the sharing of data across applications, that has become easier, you know, over time. So I think that's one thing. I think that the challenge now is, I mean, you still have that long tail, you know, right, where some of that data, you still have trouble getting data from some of the smaller suppliers. It's still sending stuff via email or attachments, you know, so you, yep. Fax, you know, they haven't gone away, right? So that's still there. That's a remnant type of issue. But I think, as we mentioned before, talked about before, I think part of the problem now is the drowning in data problem, right? So it's, gosh, we have so much data. We're measuring so many things. Are we measuring the right things to begin with? And sometimes it's, you know, we're measuring things that we don't need to be measuring, or there are things that we should be measuring, but we don't have that data. How do we get that data? Or we're getting that data, but we're getting it after the fact. So the first step is, you know, how do you define data quality, right? So I kind of view it as, you know, timely, accurate, and complete, right? And sometimes you get it in a timely manner, but it's not complete, or you get it in a timely manner and it's not accurate. Or it's accurate and complete, but you're getting it a week late, right? So I think you still have, depending on what type of data you're talking about, you know, remnants of those issues. But I think, as we've talked about before, the key thing for a lot of companies now is, all right, now I got a ton of data, especially with all this real-time stuff now, sensor data, you know, so forth. Yeah. How do I make sense out of this, and how do I come up for air?
I agree. It's almost like, you know, not seeing the forest for the trees, because I've been dumped a ton of leaves, and I get so focused on the big data. And I talk to a lot of executives, and there's a lot of confusion that large data quantity means more insights. And I'm always drawn back to what a professor here at MIT, who's since retired, Dick Larson, used to say. Instead of big data, he focused on small data. What are the two or three things you should be paying attention to? Right. And look at those, because that helps you get a bigger picture of the whole network. And instead of, there's so many people who get fixated on the leaves of the tree, they can't even see the tree, much less the forest. And that's a hard thing to train someone on.
You know, I think it is taking that step back and looking at, you know, do we need all this data that we're collecting? And how are we, you know, to the point we talked about, how exactly are we using this, or are we using it effectively? So if you're collecting data for the sake of just collecting data, you're not using it, then, you know, it begs the question, why even bother, you know, collecting that?
And there's also the problem of precision versus accuracy. A lot of people think if you go to the seventh decimal place, that it's got to be right. It's one of these things I feel like I'm go blue in the face explaining to students, is like, more data, more decimal places doesn't improve the solution if you're off by an order of magnitude.
The Excel part of the question there. Yeah, I'm a bit surprised. I think it's less of a problem today than it was in the past. I mean, I don't think we're ever going to get rid of Excel completely, and nor do I think we should, because I think Excel plays a role to play, you know, where appropriate. But I think, you know, one of the lessons learned, or one of the outcomes of the pandemic the past couple of years, is that it did truly accelerate the digital transformation efforts at a lot of companies. So a lot of companies that were, you know, 2 years ago wouldn't have surprised me, because they truly were running many of their operations with Excel. Once they started having to work from home, and, you know, it became very difficult to, you know, now you're even more than ever before emailing spreadsheets around everything else, you know, that was the, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will. And I think that, you know, I think over the past year and a half, a lot of companies are saying, hey, you know what, we can't be using Excel. We can't be using client server applications that were built in, you know, 1982 to run our operations anymore, because we're going to go out of business if we don't modernize our IT infrastructure. So I think we'll see less of Excel in critical areas moving forward.
I think people have gotten more savvy, and the software has gotten easier to use. I think of like Tableau or Power BI. They're much more democratization of a lot of this IT stuff. Also, as kind of a parallel to this, here at MIT, our master's program, it used to be people come in, they'd want to get little MBAs. They'd want to take strategy courses and this stuff. The last 5 years, they want to be data scientists, because that's what the market is asking for. And so starting 3 years ago, we require students coming into the grad program to have already taken a Python course, because we found it took too long in 1 year to teach them that and teach them everything else. But they're getting gobbled up by companies left and right, because it's all data science. So I think what people are finally, and one of the things we have to do is to rip the Band-Aid off with Excel on day one and say, you're not going to use Excel, because it's a crutch. We love it and I love it, but you need other tools there. So we only have a couple minutes left. I want to ask you one last question. We think the pandemic's going to end, right, in 2022. We're hoping, fingers crossed, and where at least it'll become endemic instead of a pandemic. What are your thoughts about the post-pandemic world? Are there any things that you learned to do, or you saw that people did in the pandemic that you think will continue? What silver linings have you seen, and what do you think will continue beyond the pandemic?
You know, I think what the pandemic revealed, and again, it wasn't rocket science. It was something everybody intuitively knew, and that is the importance of having trusted, meaningful business relationships, right? Like we talked before, you know, everyone talks about collaboration. Everybody talks about the importance of partnerships, but very few companies, you know, when the rubber meets the road, you know, actually walk that talk. And I think those companies that truly had meaningful, what I would call vested, to borrow our friend Kate Vitasek's term, vested relationships with strategic suppliers, strategic carriers, logistics service providers, strategic customers, those that had, you know, good sharing and transparency of information, you know, were honest and trusted each other. You know, those were the companies that were able to navigate most successfully through the ups and downs of the past, you know, 2 or 3 years. And my hope is that that will continue to kind of serve as a catalyst for companies to really take a step back and say, you know, do we have the best business relationships that we can potentially have, particularly with the companies that we view our strategic partners, customers, suppliers, logistics service providers, and the like. So I think building, you know, we focus so much on technology, we focus so much on the processes, and those are all important, and I'm not saying that they're not, but I hope that people also and companies focus on the relationship side of business relationships and what do they need to do to strengthen those, make those more transparent, more trust-based, more long-term in nature than, you know, tactical and just respond, you know, just responding to whatever the emergency of the day is.
But Adrian, do you think that you can maintain a trusted relationship over Zoom?
Great. You know, great question. I think it's more difficult. Yeah. I think it's going to be, I think we ultimately need to get that. There's no replacing, you know, face-to-face, you know, interaction.
Are you sure? Because something like this, for us to have this, if we're going to do this not digitally, right? Because we're doing this over the internet and you had to physically come here, right? And do this stuff. I would almost argue there's some things that Zoom or Teams or whatever your situation is better than in person for some things. But then in person, there is no substitute for certain things as well.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, from a scalability standpoint, obviously the technology side is great. I mean, you can have you don't have to get on a plane. You can have many more people participate in discussions than you could.
It's another tool in the toolkit. It doesn't replace, but I don't think it goes away. I don't think Zoom or any of this video conferencing is going away anytime soon.
I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon either. I think it will be a part of the way we interact and communicate and share information with one another. Just like, you know, on a related matter, even just conferences, right? I think the you know, they all unfortunately had to go digital because of the pandemic. We're seeing some of them coming back now to in-person, but I think that moving forward, there will be a digital, you know, component to it. I think quickly, just to add, the other thing I think that's important to kind of to wrap back to what we talked about earlier, I think it's preparing for the next potential disruption, right? And I think when we surveyed our Indago community, the number one thing that came up in terms of the risk or threat that they need to prepare for was a cyber attack or cyber threat.
Sure.
And I think we've seen examples of that over the past few years of even companies like FedEx and Maersk and Renault and others that have been impacted by cyber attacks. I think that it wouldn't surprise me, going back to what surprises me, what doesn't surprise me, it wouldn't surprise me if there's some kind of major supply chain disruption due to a cyber attack in the next 1 or 2 or 3 years.
That makes sense. No, I sadly agree with you for that. But one last thing about the connections of Zoom and all this kind of stuff. I think I've got the theory and it's not my own, but if you have a beer with someone, you form the relationship. And then beyond that, you can talk on the phone, do whatever. So I think maintaining a relationship, you could do it after face-to-face. But question to you, do you think you can establish a new one purely digital? Or do you think you need that in-person thing to start a relationship? What do you think?
I think the ideal is, you know, the face-to-face, but we're no longer, you know, the ideal is no longer possible or potentially possible, yeah. Right? So I think what's more important than the medium of how you establish that relationship is how you actually manage it moving forward. And it all boils down to, you know, the number one thing, there was an Indago member, we did some research around this and, you know, around business relationships. And one of the members, I'm going to paraphrase here, said, you know, the biggest thing that builds trust for me is honesty. And the biggest thing that erodes or destroys trust for me is dishonesty. So if you're honest with me, it doesn't matter if you're honest with me on the phone, via Zoom or face-to-face and you're being transparent, that's going to build the trust, the relationship. But if you lie to me and then burns me, you know, that's, you know, so like anything else, when you establish a relationship, there's going to take some time to build that trust, right? And what builds trust, I think it's honesty, transparency, and ongoing communication.
All right. And with that, we'll have to honestly say the time is up. So thanks, Adrian. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed talking with you.
Bro, great. Thanks. Thanks for having me, Chris. Look forward to chatting again and hopefully, you know, sometime down the road in person.
We can see in person instead of on a computer screen. That would be great. All right, everyone, stay tuned for the market update with Dr. Enam Ayula.
Welcome to the over-the-road truckload market update for January 13th, 2022. Again, we did skip the last update, which was the end of the 2021. So for those who are keeping track of the numbers, just FYI. So let's start with dry van. Active rates are flat. Spot rates are flat. Replacement rate is positive 12%. This means the new contract rates are about 12% above the rates being replaced. On the temp control side, active rates are up 0.5%, spot rates down 2%, and replacement rate is positive 22%. In a modal, active rates are up 1%, spot rates up 1%, and replacement rates positive 10%. Finally, on the flatbed side, active rates are down 0.5%, spot rates up 3%, and replacement rate is positive 6%.
All right. So Enam, it looks like the dry van and even temp control is kind of flattening out. What do you think the big takeaways are?
Since we are still seeing the replacement rates strong positive, I'm assuming it is going to be a very temporary thing, and it may be also related to slowing down of the market in the last few weeks of the year, 2021. But I'm not that bullish about rates dropping from here onwards, from an active rates perspective. If you look at the spot market, it's been bouncing around. We have been talking about this in the previous updates. It's, you know, a few weeks up, few weeks down. There's nothing significant one side or the other. But what's more interesting for me from an active rates perspective is the rates that we would see in the next few weeks. You know, quite a bit of the shippers did their annual bids in Q4. So these rates are going to roll out. It's already, you know, typically those rates go active in, you know, in January. So we would see those rates coming in. That will give us a very good indicator of what the new rates that are coming into the market.
And it seems like the new rate, you know, replacement rates are 12%, you know, low double digits and temp control at 20%. That's matching what we hear anecdotally from people for results coming back from RFPs, right?
Yes, absolutely. But also, I think that the biggest if or the condition that we are continuing to watch now is this whole labor effect Omicron's causing.
Right.
I mean, is it a significant enough of a disruption that it is going to, you know, be, you know, create another jolt into the system to throw things off? Or is it, you know, going to kind of be mild enough?
Yeah, well, it's having an effect. It's having an effect in China. Ningbo was shut down and now it's coming up. So it's pausing manufacturing at different plants too. And I guess Volkswagen was slowed down. And I was talking to some other manufacturers here in the US, and it's not just labor shortage on the docks or in the DC or drivers, it's manufacturing floor. So a lot of times the pace of manufacturing a product is slowing down too, which is, could cause its other problems. So yeah, it could be a major impact, right?
Yeah. So we'll continue to watch. But I think bigger organizations, I think what's interesting is already taking this into account in the sense that, you know, have thought about this scenario. What if, you know, the whole COVID thing doesn't go away? How are we going to thrive in this condition rather than hampered down. So I think that that has been many companies part of the planning process that was in 2021. So hopefully we can better manage this situation than how it was before.
All right. So that concludes this week's Truckload Market Update. Thanks, Ina.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Freight Find. The Freight Find podcast is hosted by Dr. Ina Mayoub and myself, Chris Kaplis, and is produced and edited by DATIQ. For more information or to hear previous episodes, please visit our website at dat.com/podcasts. You can subscribe to The Freight Find wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to give us a review. As always, if you have any feedback or questions about what you've heard on The Freight Find or suggestions for what you'd like to hear in the future, send an email to me at chris.kaplis@dat.com. Finally, from all of us at The Freight Find, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it and learned something new.